everyone. Please be seated. Please come out of the environment. Housekeeping or other preliminary matters, anybody? I need to talk to Mr. Matheson.
Thank you. Good morning, sir. I just wanted to, as a courtesy, advise the court that my co-counsel, Mr. Thompson,
yes,
is at a close family bereavement, so he won't be here this week, and I shall do my best to keep the good chip, beef and lamb New Zealand off the rocks in his absence, but he'll hopefully be with us in week three.
Well, let you know. Thank you for advising us. Our condolences go to him and to his family. I had noticed that the legal submissions are joint submissions.
Yes.
And if anything, if any other arrangement needs to be made to assist you or your team in relation to that, just let us know.
Thank you very much.
Anything to make things easier for Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? No.
I thought I would start, sir, with the question we ended with yesterday and the high-level response that we were seeking this morning. And so just to reframe that question, it was around, I guess, the Director General reflecting on the appeal points she is seeking or has set out in her appeal notice. And in light of last week's hearing and the issues that have arisen, what is the Director General looking for in this process? And so at a high level, I think the guidance she gave yesterday was around in terms of the Director General's statutory function and in terms of the Te Reo Whaimana. And so if I could just start there firstly, as indicated in the submissions, the director's role in terms of the functions here is around the advocacy of conservation and natural resources, and in particular the preservation and protection of freshwater fisheries. And so when you look at conservation, it's defined as preservation and protection. In my submission, that falls in line with the Te Reo Whaimana around restoration and protection. So we've got a similar framework, if you like, that the Director General is operating within alongside Te Reo Whaimana. And so with that context in mind, that's the headstand, I suppose, that we came to this appeal process with, is the advocacy around the values that need to be protected in this region in light of the extent of degradation. And so I have been reflecting, sir, Judge Williams, on the question yesterday. And in terms of identifying equal interests and how we can reflect those better in what we take in terms of advocacy, yes, we could have done a better job of that on reflection. I do know, though, that I've been involved. Not often does a lawyer or a doc be involved from the beginning to the end, but in this instance, unfortunately, we have been. And so we were engaged with iwi prior to submission to seek their review so that we could take those into account when putting our submission in. There are challenges, as you will no doubt appreciate when engaging with iwi, particularly when they've got a number of other issues on the go. Time poor, often, just through reality of the processes that they engage in. And so we did attend at that stage. I do recall, because I attended that meeting, to understand their concerns, but headspace was somewhere else at that time. And so we have been reaching out along the way. I have been reaching out to my friend in this process to understand their position, to ensure that we navigate the director's case in a way that supports that position so as to give effect to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. So, I acknowledge your question, then yes, could have done better, and in future plan changes, we keep striving to do that. observation fails over everything, and we've only just since 2018 having two makeshift, and with our previous director general to navigate in a different way and in a different space, and we're still learning that. We haven't got it right, and we're trying to get there.
I'm not blind to the fact that the aspiration, I think, and which comes through your submissions too, is focusing on restoration and protection component of deserved homeowners. So, but it's there. I just thought I'd look at where the expansion could have been. That was the reason for my question.
Yes, sir. And so outside of this process, and my friend will probably be better to talk to the conservation accords that we've linked into with like Waikato Tainui. I mean, we have now, as a result of that decision, treaty implementation ranges on the ground working with iwi. So a lot of the outcomes for conservation is achieved on the ground often, as opposed to a lot of the processes the department engages in. And so just getting back to the question, Your Honour, around what is the Director General seeking in this process. Again, I've taken instructions on that too to get that clear. And our direction remains the same in terms of lakes and wetlands. That is our focus in this plan change. And the stock exclusions is a measure to, in our view, to achieve the protection required to reduce the extent of degradation of these water bodies. And so we continue to pursue those through this process. And the issue around ephemeral waterways is pertinent in terms of lakes and wetlands, because it's those areas that feed into these lakes and wetlands that need to be managed as well. So, I guess at a high level that we continue to pursue relief in relation to those points in particular.
Thank you for that. I do think that the way in which a perspective may change over time is an important point. It was driven home to me during the Environmental Defence Society and King Salmon litigation that at times people lose sight of the fact that within Section 5 of the Resource Management Act, protection is part of sustainable management. It's not just about enabling certain things, it's also about protecting resources. And so I do acknowledge, and I looked through the Naitaiki Kamiki case last night and noted what the Supreme Court said there in 2018, and I think there's some convergence. It is very helpful for you to indicate that that's your primary focus in relation to this.
Yes.
Freshwater fisheries, lakes and wetlands, the degree of protection and stock exclusion provisions, and then we get down to probably the crunch area of ephemeral waterways and how we properly identify those and how we can best protect them to the extent that is feasible in the circumstances. And we've had a number of discussions about feasibility and I suppose about the question of making sure that we don't perhaps let our reach exceed our grasp in relation to some of these controls. And there'll be issues, as I'm sure you expect, in relation to things like mapping, the maps, the GIS databases that are available, and then the extent to which the information we may get from the mapping should then be applied in terms of the nature of the controls that are imposed on the use of the land that has been mapped.
Yes, sir. And the Director General has always been alive to the issue of cost in terms of the measures that we're seeking through this process.
Yes.
We're not blind to that, and hence the need to bring the economics to the table from
yes.
our perspective. And we're willing to work however we can with the parties to achieve good outcomes for those water bodies.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, the other thing that you were going to do, you were considering the extent to which you needed to cover any of the particulars from about, I think, about paragraph 30 of your submissions and on through. Again, that's for you. We have the material in writing. You don't need to rehearse that to ensure that we understand it. So you can go to whichever point you particularly wish to at this stage.
Thank you, sir. Well, I might just, in terms of the National Policy Statement on page 17, the point being made in those paragraphs is in relation to policy 5 and the importance of the guidelines or the principles set out in the MPSFM, appendix 6 and 7, and the concern the Director General has with the reference to offsets and compensation in policy 5, when I understand the evidence from the Council is that that's not the offsetting or compensation that's being referred to in that policy. So the issue I guess I'm raising in those paragraphs is then what is the guidance available for that type of offset or compensation that the Council is proposing. So I'll leave that there because Dr. Corkin can speak to that in her evidence. I also just mentioned the Waikato Conservation Management Strategy. There may be some provisions in there, particularly around the fundamental agreement. So just for context, the Conservation Management Strategy will be called CMS, binds the department in a way in which it is to manage the land that it administers. So the objectives, the policies and methods outlined in that document is what the department uses when it goes out to manage land. So we thought that might be, and I've listed the reference in footnote 76 there,
yes.
If that would be any assistance to the court. And so, turning now to the appeal point, I suppose making the point here is that the appeal points the Director General submission on is around the target, is around ensuring that those attribute targets can be achieved in the short term and the long term. And so the extent to which we engaged was to ensure that there was a strengthened framework around that to make sure those targets are achieved. That's the end goal that we're seeking here. And so we had a concern there with table 3.11.2, the prioritisation of contaminants table. The Director General is seeking wording in policy 1A to specify that the reductions in the four contaminants concentration required under PC1 are directly linked to table 3.11.1 rather than relying on a general improvement wording. And so to the extent of improvement in water quality required in table 3.11.1A to C, Ms. Kissick's evidence is that these tables provide current state and interim and ATE target attribute states for each of the four contaminants by subcatchment. So basically, their current states and target attribute state concentrations are not the same. Reduction in that specific contaminant is needed in that subcatchment. And there's also explanatory notes to provide some guidance around that. And so the table 3, level 2, which deals with the prioritisation of contaminants, and the actions to manage those, the Director General is setting that to be deleted in its entirety. I note that currently the post-conferencing version of PC1 has proposed to delete that, and for the reasons set out in particularly the water quality joint witness statement, which is around having to focus on all contaminants because all contaminants are important. No one has priority over the other.
In relation to that, well, when you say all contaminants, you mean all four or do you mean a wider range of matters?
All four contaminants.
All four, yes.
You said we're mindful that the scope of this particular process of those four contaminants.
Indeed, and there are some questions around the extent to which the plan change might be expanded. For example, it might have particular matters in it to address dissolved oxygen.
Yes, sir.
We raised that with Mr. Trebilko.
Yes, sir.
And obviously there's a question in terms of a long-term process and in terms of what we are likely to achieve over the next few years, possibly 10 years, whether we keep our focus on things rather than let our focus get diffuse, to use the word in the
And so just moving on from the table 3.11.2 in terms of policy 2, this is the policy that supports, in our view, the need for stock exclusion. So starting here at paragraph 62, policy 2B, B and C against somebody with moderate or high risk of dispute, discharges of one or more of the four contaminants, illustrates through farm environment plans the risk of diffused discharges is as low as practical given current land use and over an appropriate specified period of time. And so according to policy 2BDI, any relevant resource consent or EPP should have regard to the relative vulnerability of the land to diffuse discharges of one or more of the contaminants. This includes a specific requirement to have regard to sensitivity of the receiving environment, including the presence of lakes and wetlands and the likelihood of runoff into the surface waterways. The Director General seeks the words and or leaching are inserted into policy 2BD in the second bullet point after the word runoff and before the words to surface. So this is a recommendation that Mr. McArthur supports. The reference to sensitive receiving environment, but the wording likely of runoff to surface waterways should also include leaching. That's all part and parcel of that, and so it will better capture the effects of different contaminant pathways. So in terms of what we're speaking in that regard, we're asking for the reference to leaching to also be included. The Director General seeks the deletion of the words minimise in policy 2BF. The first bullet point, Mr. McArthur's evidence is that it's difficult to technically support the words minimise or minimise given that E. coli is a major, if not the most pervasive water quality issue that affects people's safe contact with water in the Waikato and Waipa catchments. And so that comes back to Te Ture Whaimana in terms of the ability to get food and to swim in the river.
But if there are crosslings and so on, I mean, is absolute prevention achievable?
I think that...
let me go back. The sub-policy starts with the word generally. So I just wonder whether or not or minimise reflects the fact that the policy is general.
I suppose what we're looking at, sir, is to make it as ambitious as possible. It's coming back to ensure that those targets are reached, and the science is telling us that minimising is sufficient enough. There should be a prevention.
Well, certainly that might be the target. As I say, ultimately in terms of the policy, it will come down to the way in which particular farm environment plans are drafted and the way in which crossings are actually minimised or crossings are structured in a way. Of course, one of the things would be that it may be that as a result of that, crossings may need to be covered, and you don't want too many covers over waterways.
So just moving to Schedule C, there's these soft exclusions and conservation exclusions are. And I'm mindful that our evidence hasn't focused as much on the cultivation effects, but I guess the point to be made here is that any activity that exposes the ground is at risk of running into the waterways. So whether that's farming or conservation, the effects are the same in my submission. And so with the stock exclusions the Director General considers wider setbacks, distances from water bodies for stock and conservation. So specifically, just to make it clear, the Director General was seeking 10 metres setback distance from the edge of the bed of all lakes. Now, I expect there may be some confusion there in terms of what the Director General is seeking, given the Director General's lake expert is recommending 20 metres, and that was the recommendation at the council level for the same scientific reasons around the birch effect. So put simply, and Dr. Stewart can speak to this from a scientific perspective, but the issue there is that when lakes are low and there is pasture there to be farmed, that can be fertilised and when lakes aren't flooded. Once those lakes are flooded, it just takes all that nutrient back into the waterways. And so the recommendation seemed to avoid that, to have a wider buffer. However, when making a decision on what setbacks to seek when putting in the Director General's appeal notice, Director General was aware of that issue, having presented it in the council hearing. We were mindful of the stock exclusions coming in at that time, proposing a 3 metre setback that hadn't been promulgated fully at that stage. And so decision makers for the Director General took that into account, but noted that there were a lot of factors that 3 metre hadn't accounted for in terms of the benefits of shading when you have a wider buffer, when you have vegetation there, the benefits of a wider buffer being infiltrating more contaminants, but also in this particular region, the issue of sediment, which it may not be an issue as much around the other regions, which we don't think those sort of regions had turned its mind to. So we took those factors into account. We looked at the science. The science is telling us that anything between 5 and 10, you have increased benefits. Anything beyond 10, those benefits don't increase as much. And so we had to take into account the cost of what we're seeking here. We landed at 10 metres. And so that is what the director continues to seek in relation to lakes, the edge of any wetlands, 50 metres square size and over, and the edge of the bed of permanent rivers. So seek a 3 metre setback from the outer edge of the bed of any other rivers, which would include the ephemerals. Studies have shown the first 5 metres of riparian buffer zone with perennial ryegrass filter strips were critical to remove large particles of sediment. Some authors reported an optimal buffer width of 10 metres for fine sediment removal. Ms. McArthur supports this buffer distance for farming and cultivation vegetable production. Stock access to wetlands directly impacts vegetation and soil structure in riparian zones adjacent to wetlands and contributes to soil erosions. So the biomass of existing vegetation is reduced, which limits the growth of new vegetation. Loss of dense vegetation and soil distribution within the riparian zone reduces the attenuation capacity, which leads to higher levels of nutrients and sediment discharges into the wetlands. Dr. Robertson considers the wetland systems of the Waikato and Waipa catchments are susceptible to water quality contamination, and it is appropriate to apply a 10-metre setback for natural wetlands, not just those wetlands in the Table 3.7.7 of the regional plan. The joint witness statement for wetlands, the experts agree that wetlands are the most nutrient-sensitive receiving environment within the PC1 area, not just those in the table. There is no technical basis for only applying the 10-metre wetland setback to those listed in the table. Other wetlands not listed are also vulnerable to water decline or water quality decline. And so for lakes, stock excursions in setback areas around lakes protect the water quality of lakes, especially during periods of high water when riparian margins flood, as I've explained. And a lake is defined as a body of fresh water which is entirely or nearly surrounded by land. A wetland includes permanently or intermittently wet areas, shallow water, and land margins that support the natural ecosystem of plants and animals that are adapted to wetter conditions. A lake can include a wetland, often around its margins. There is also areas beyond the bed of lakes on the land where are stored in intermittently wet areas and support natural ecosystems of plants and animals adapted to wet conditions. And beyond the bed of a lake, there may be areas of wetland meeting statutory definition. And Dr. Robertson will speak to this in terms of, I was hearing the questions last week around, well, where would a 10 metre setback start from? Dr. Robertson can speak to that in terms of a scientific perspective where that should be, taking into account those definitions. So Dr. Stewart's evidence is that lakes fluctuate in water level in response to high or prolonged rain, and there's an example there with Lake Wahi, where it fluctuated up to 3 metres vertically and annually, resulting in a more than 30% change in surface area. An assessment of the impact of a 1.5 metre water increase in that lake. And again, Dr. Stewart can speak to this, but it overall supports the need for wider setbacks as recommended from Dr. Stewart. His view is that a 20 metre setback is more appropriate given these fluctuations in lake levels and particularly in the high rainfall which we have been experiencing recently. And so under Clause 9, Schedule C, no conservation is to occur within 5 metres of any water body described in Clause 5. As currently worded, the 5 metre setback in Clause 9 does not apply to commercial vegetable production. The Director General does not support this. The Director General seeks 10 metre setbacks for water bodies for conservation, including for CVP. Ms. McArthur's evidence, as I mentioned, is that cultivation and CVP involve the exposure of bare ground and mechanical working of that ground. These are high-risk practices for erosion and sediment loss that, in Ms. McArthur's opinion, are best managed by taking a coordinated approach, which includes setbacks and riparian buffers. A 5-metre buffer is unlikely to be adequate to protect critical habitats at risk and threaten Indigenous aquatic life from sediment effects. This includes effects on fish which spawn in the riparian margins of rivers and lakes in the lower waters. And so the JWS for Water Quality agrees that if CVP land uses were allowed to expand, resulting in increased nitrogen or other contaminant losses, then catchments with sensitive water bodies like lakes, wetlands, should be avoided. And so just turning now to the critical source areas, which include the ephemeral and intermittent streams. Headwater streams, including ephemeral and intermittent streams, are crucial for sustaining the structure, function, productivity and biodiversity of downstream ecosystems. Intermittent and ephemeral headwater habitats can have high biodiversity, even when there is only a thin film of water, and may also harbour headwater specialists or endemic species. And again, Ms. McArthur can speak to this, but she states that ephemeral streams are critical sources of contaminants, transport from the land to water, and should be identified on farm within FEPs. And so the JWS Water Quality agreed that mitigation to manage critical source areas should include temporary or permanent fencing. Experts also agreed that it would be useful to have a map of these streams and in PC1, but the resolution to guide on farm definition of these water bodies is not sufficient, so there is some challenges around mapping, we expect that. Ms. McArthur notes the JWS for water quality that most ephemeral waterways should be captured by the definition of critical source area, as referred to in the JWS and Mr. Tribilco's rebuttal evidence. She also notes that setbacks are an appropriate mitigation for critical source areas to reduce transporting contaminants into the stream network. So I guess that just emphasises, as I've said, we're focusing on the lakes and wetlands, but we have to focus on those areas that are a source of contaminant to those water bodies, which the science is telling us is the ephemeral streams. We then come to the stock exclusion regulations. So stock exclusions include beef cattle, dairy cattle, and dairy support cattle, deer or pigs. The stock exclusions proposed in Schedule C capture farm cattle, horses, deer and pigs, and under Regulation 8, stock required by the regulations to be excluded from lakes and wider rivers must not be allowed closer than 3 metres. And so we're seeking that a rule needs to be in place that is more stringent than the regulation. A 3 metre setback rule in Regulation 8 does not apply if stock need to access areas in order to enter or exit a dedicated bridge or culvert, or stock are actively driven across the lake or wider river and do not cross the same area more than twice in any month. So regulation is subject to Regulation 7, and under that regulation, 3 metre setback rules does not apply if it is too difficult to install a dedicated bridge or culvert, where the river has highly mobile bed, and stock are supervised and actively driven across the river. So furthermore, the regulations were amended, and under that amendment, 3 metre setback will not apply to all parts of the lake or wide river if on the 5th of October an existing permanent fence or riparian vegetation that excludes the stock is in place. So I guess what I'm getting to, sir, is that there needs to be far more stringent provisions in the plan change than what's provided for in the stop exclusion. And so just moving down into the GIS evidence, Dr. Bradshaw carried out an analysis to calculate the additional land area that would result from increasing stock exclusion setback distances from 3 metres to 10 metres, so that's that 7 metre difference that we calculated. Dr. Bradshaw's analysis also provides an indication of the probable different areas of land use in the increased setback area. For calculating setback areas for rivers, Dr. Bradshaw used the river environment classification version 5, and I should signal just on that we have got a correction to Dr. Bradshaw's evidence around one of the data sets used. So the data set was due to in the water quality JWS, I think it was the Healthy Rivers Catchment data set. Dr. Bradshaw has run those numbers to reflect what was in the JWS, and so there has been consequential amendments to the plans set out in Dr. Bradshaw's evidence, which I have copies here and will circulate those, but I just wanted to signal this to the court now. And so he's used the river environment classification for the river data stream order numbers that denote the position of each section of river within the catchment drainage network. In the JWS, REC2 databases are likely to capture the total extent of all ephemeral streams. In the JWS GIS, it also noted, as advised from Ms. MacArthur, that the reclassification of stream order does not always align with the ephemeral or intermittent stream types identified in Schedule C. However, there are no better models of stream type available to undertake an analysis of spatial extent of the stream types in Schedule C, and the REC was the best tool available. For lakes and wetlands, Dr. Bradshaw combined the GIS layers of the Topo 50 lakes and freshwater ecosystem, and he can speak to those. And under the JWS for GIS, it was agreed that Dr. Bradshaw's analysis is likely to be an underestimate with a large number of smaller wetlands not being captured. However, Dr. Robertson notes in the comments of that JWS that the FENS wetlands database captures 15,800 hectares, an additional 2,000 wetlands at 250 square metres would equate to around 50 hectares. So whilst we've got different data sets being used, the end result isn't that much different, and you'll see with Dr. Bradshaw's corrections who those lines are. Dr. Bradshaw states in his evidence that his analysis came with limitations. These are the rivers are dynamic and may alter spatially. REC2 data are modelled, and the location of these modelled rivers may differ from the actual river location or from other data sets. The stream order for specific river types are assumed for modelling purposes and may not reflect flow characteristics of the river type. And GIS analysis can give an inflated impression of data accuracy, providing values to many decimal places when rounding off. So there were limitations to what could be achieved through the GIS mapping, is the point there. And so the Director General accepts there may be underestimates with some of Dr. Bradshaw's calculations, which is unsurprising given the limitations. However, there was never any intent for an analysis to be an exact science of accounting, but rather an estimate of the additional area that would be captured by the proposed 10 metre setbacks using the best information and GIS tools available. Dr. Bradshaw's analysis was also undertaken to help inform the Section 32AA evaluation and the court decision making. It's important to note that the experts in the GIS conferencing, that's Dr. Bradshaw and Dr. Lemur for Federated Farmers, agreed with the methodology Dr. Bradshaw used to assess the setback areas. The experts also agree that from a GIS perspective, REC2 is the national recognised database for river systems. Taupo is the recognised database for lake systems. And while Dr. Lemur had not used the FENS database before, Dr. Bradshaw believed it was the most appropriate database to use. Now turning to the section 32AA further evaluation for the 10 metre setbacks the Director General is seeking. And I think it's important to just set that out first because it's quite a big part of the Director General's case in terms of the cost benefits analysis. So in accordance with 32AA1, the Act, a further evaluation is required for any changes that have been proposed for PC1 since completing the evaluation in section 32 of the Act. The further evaluation under 32AA must be carried out in accordance with 32.1 to subsection 4, but despite 32.1B and 32.1C must be undertaken at a level of detail that corresponds to the scale and significance of the changes. The section 32AA further evaluation of the Director General's proposed change from 3 metres under the regulation or 5 metres proposed by Council to 10 metre water body setbacks from stock and conservation exclusions, which are the changes being sought here, must examine the extent to which objectives, and so objectives is defined in the Act to include for a proposal that contains or sets objectives, those objectives, or for all other proposals such as these 10 metre setbacks, the purpose of those proposals. So that when it refers to objectives, it's the purpose of those stock excursion is what those objectives are referring to here in my submission. So objectives of the changes being evaluated are the most appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the Act. The further evaluation must specifically examine whether the changes are the most appropriate way to achieve the objectives in PC1. This includes identifying other reasonably practicable options for achieving the objectives, assessing the efficiency and effectiveness of the provisions and achieving the objectives, and reasons for deciding on the provisions. The objectives relevant to PC1 and to stock and cultivation exclusions that I submit a further evaluation under 32AA should consider are the objectives 1, 2, 3 and 5 proposed in PC1, as well as the purpose of stock exclusion. Both stock and cultivation exclusions will help to reduce the discharge into water bodies of one or more of the four contaminants. The experts agreed in the water quality conferencing that stock exclusion and setbacks for pastoral grazing, cultivation, trap and races, etc. from water bodies will reduce inputs of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and E. coli to water bodies. The efficiency and effectiveness assessment required as part of the further evaluation must identify and assess the benefits and costs of the environmental, economic, social and cultural effects anticipated from the implementation of the changes, including any increase or reduction in opportunities for economic growth and employment. Only where it is practicable is there a requirement to quantify the anticipated benefits and costs of any anticipated effects. However, an assessment of the risk of acting or not acting if there is uncertain or insufficient information about the changes is required. Relevantly, under 32 subsection 4, where a change imposes a greater restriction on an activity than a restriction imposed in a national environmental standard, the further evaluation report must examine whether the restriction is justified in the circumstances of the region in which the change will have effect. And in my submission, the Director General considers it is justified given the extent of degradation in this region in terms of water body. And so I refer now to the Meridian Energy Limited case. That considered the cost benefits analysis. And so I think set out there, sir, and the point I'm wanting to take or emphasise from this problem is that the issue of whether 32 requires a strict economic theory or efficiency or more holistic approach for days in the contact energy decision. He declined to interfere with the Environment Court's conclusion that while economic evidence can be useful, section 32 analysis requires a wider exercise of judgment This reflects that it is simply not possible to express some benefits or costs in dollar or economic terms. For example, the loss of an ecosystem, such as a wetland, hosting a large bird population, which is going to be overwhelmed by, in that case, land reclamation, may not be capable of expression in dollar terms. And so likewise, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to express some of the criteria within Part 2 of the Act in terms of quantitative values. We take, by way of example, the following paragraphs in Section 7, the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values, intrinsic values and ecosystems, maintenance and enhancement of quality of the environment. So that if any of these matters are relevant, the consultative authority shall have particular regard to them, even if they are only capable of expression in qualitative and as opposed to quantitative terms. As put the late, so, and then it goes on to the details of that decision. So I guess the point being made there is that when we were quantifying the value of the benefit to the water bodies that will result from these proposed 10 metre setbacks, it's not possible to quantify those in dollar terms as set out in that decision. So that's the point I wanted to reach there. And so currently under Section 32AA and through Section 32, only requires benefits and costs to be quantified if practicable, otherwise these only need to be identified and assessed. The earlier version of Section 32 discussed the meridian required an evaluation to take into account the benefits and costs of policies, rules or other methods. The Court said this provision did not carry any mandatory requirement for all the benefits and costs to be quantified in economic terms, and that no such requirement can be reasonably inferred. And so in my submission, the approach taken by the Court in Meridian should be applied to 32.2a. A wide exercise of judgment is required, as it is not practicable to express the benefits or cost in economic terms. The loss of a population of species from a blackwater event in a lake or wetland receiving excess nutrient and sediment discharges may not be capable of expression in economic terms, but it is still a cost to be considered as part of the Section 32.a further evaluation. So too are the cost of implementing 10 metre setbacks along with the benefits. So we're not close to the fact that there will be costs here, but there will also be benefits to be gained. Quantifying the costs and benefits is only required as practicable, and the term practicable was discussed by the High Court in the Tauranga Environmental Protection Society decision. And so in that decision, practicable is a word that takes its colour from the context in which it's used. In some contexts, the focus is on what is able to be done physically, and others focus is more on what can reasonably be done in the particular circumstances, taking a range of factors into account. Unlike the Court of Appeal, we do not find a dictionary definition of much assistance, given the flexibility of the word and the importance of the context to determine its meaning. Just providing some guidance here on what practicable should mean in this context serves.
Normally, the context will mean something more than just feasible. And certainly, I'm not sure of any case where practicable means at any cost. The usual context, and certainly the context in which the word is used in the Resource Management Act, which is limited. Nonetheless, cost is one of the factors to be taken into account. Accept it's a relevant factor?
Definitely, sir. Within the framework of Section 32.
Yes.
Yes. And so I turn now to the economics evidence. So the 10 metre setbacks would utilise land that would otherwise be used for primary production. This is an opportunity cost, the foregone profit that could have been derived from the land in primary production had it not been for the setbacks. Dr. Bradshaw's analysis calculates that for the PC1 area, the additional area required for 10 metre setbacks affects approximately 6,746 hectares of land, will result in annual lost profit in primary production and in the range of 8 million to 16 million. Noting that we do have some corrections there that will be handed up, Mr. Counsel, the Director General's economist, acknowledges that this figure is likely to be a conservative conservative estimate, and it assumes all the land affected by setbacks is productive arable land, and that this may not be the case. There are also agricultural production benefits from increased setbacks, including reduced soil loss and improved drinking water for stock. The JWS economics expert agreed that Dr. Bradshaw's modelling identifies 6,746 hectares of additional land that will be required, and the council's modelling done by the technical leaders group, 4PC1, identifies 11,349. And so that's the modelling that, or the corrections that Dr. Bradshaw has done and has come up with that figure, so there's no inconsistency there. Mr. Council comments that even with the higher figure used by the TRG, it still only equates to a small proportion of total farm profitability relative to the annual variation in total farm profit. And he will speak to that in detail. Mr. Council did not seek to quantify in his evidence all the possible costs associated with implementing the 10 setbacks. 10 year setbacks. And that's in recognition of the fact that we're not farmers, we don't know farming.
Well, I mean, obviously there are questions there, and I don't know how we need to pursue it with Mr. Council, as well as the calculation of the area, which is a GIS exercise. I have no doubt that there'll be questions asked about the fact that in a particular location on a particular farm, a setback of 10 metres will run into some other problems. And there can, so it may be conservative in terms of notional area, it may actually not be conservative in terms of what the knock-on effects of such setbacks could be. I mean, that was some of what we had evidence last week about from Mr. Broxhoek, about where you were putting a setback in, where, for example, a steep slope is adjacent to the stream, and how you might actually manage a setback from that. Whether you could do it strictly on a 3 or 10 metre basis, or whether you'd actually have to go further back because of the topography. Do you recall that evidence?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, in generalities, I suppose it's of some use that we have people who are doing desktop exercises to identify this.
Yes.
I think we have said on several occasions already there will be on-the-ground assessments that need to be done, and the question is whether or not the rules are written in a way that enables that to be done sensibly for both the quality of the water and for the nature of the activity occurring adjacent to the water.
Yes, and farm environmental plans might be...
Exactly. That's right. And so, I'm just... You know, floating the idea about the extent to which, given that there will be discretionary consenting exercises in many of the most significant cases, and how much we should give for guidance to those discretionary exercises rather than trying to set rules that will have to be departed from in particular cases.
Yes, sir. So the matters of discretion are quite important.
Indeed. And that comes back to the whole thing about the way in which the policies and objectives are worded, because those should be the things which guide the exercise of discretion.
Yes, Thank you. And so just picking up at paragraph 107, Mr. Council, yeah, we'll pause there. So the economics, economics agreed in response to question 3, yeah, is it possible to estimate the magnitude of additional cost and factors? Is it due to uncertainty with how much each farm will be affected, total aggregate cost for PC1 area cannot be easily calculated. This will require extremely large modelling exercise. So that if that picks up on that point in terms of the factors that will provide the potential to offset additional cost of implementing 10-metre setbacks, although variable for different provinces, include flood damage risk, stock health benefits, prevention of livestock drowning, and reduction of soil loss. According to the JWS water quality, the degree of reduction in all four contaminants required to achieve target attribute states will involve multiple methods being required in many sub-catchments. So we're open, you know, there may be other measures available to help reduce this, and we're open to hearing what those are. peak IVI concentrations have generally increased in the catchment, including that stock excursion setbacks implemented to date are insufficient, and greater extent of stock excursion and control of critical source areas need to be considered. Stock exclusion is important to achieve reductions in sediment loads and E. coli from pasture land. Just to confirm, because I think we may have been may not have clarified the point in terms of the setbacks being sought, but just to confirm, they are 10 metre setbacks. Just making the point that in terms of we're seeking a consequential amendment to policy 2B G&H so that the wording requires setbacks from water bodies and riparian wonders for activity. This aligns with strategy K of Tetere Whaimana, which ensures that cumulative adverse effects on Waikato River of activities are appropriately managed in statutory planning documents at the time of their review. So I'm trying to just to get some alignment there with Tetere Whaimana. And so now moving on from stock exclusions to policy 5, I think I've made the point there, sir, is that it's directly genuine evidence that any reference to offset for compensation should be in accordance with the guidelines, the best practice guidelines, which takes into account 11 principles for product offsetting and 13 for compensation. The Director General's appeal notice focused only on two of those principles, and that was around additionality. So the principle is that additionality should be something more than what's already required. If that principle isn't met, then that calls into question whether it's an offset. And then the other one is around permanence, that the offset remain in place for the duration of the effect. That is another principle guidance under the ESFM and just as best practice guidance. So what the concern is for the Director General is what's being proposed in Policy 5 is more nutrient trading as opposed to offset and compensation. And the concern there that is if it is nutrient trading, then it should say so. And the concern then for the Director General is that there isn't much good guidance or practice guidance notes or anything to provide what nutrient trading should look like and whether that's appropriate. There's a lot of gaps there and knowledge around that is the evidence from Dr. Corkery, so she will speak to that directly. And so I've also covered policies 12 and 13 for points of discharge, but I could leave that for the separate hearing to talk to those points. And so just moving forward to page 37, paragraph 130, so this is related to lakes and wetlands. So policy 15 is about restoring and protecting lakes, whereas policy 17 is about restoring and protecting wetlands other than farmland. The Director General seeks the retention of both policies, but with some amendments. The focus of policy 15 is too narrow, and it only provides for riverine and peat lakes, not all lakes. But this has been broadened in Mr. Tabelco's rebuttal evidence. Policy, so that amendment is acceptable and addresses the Director General's concern here. In terms of policy 17, the Director General sought greater clarity on what the significant values and uses of wetlands are. Considered the policy should refer to restoring and protecting ecosystem health and specify the actions required to improve wetland values. The planning experts have agreed to wetland for policy 17. It does not include reference to table 3, 311D, as this table contains lakes. So I think where it's landed now with the post-conferencing version is that there's no reference to the table in that policy, and we think that there should be a reference to, in order to tie the actions to the target. There is a table proposed in Mr. Maher's evidence for fish and game that combines narrative attribute states and different types of wetlands that would be appropriate table to be inserted into policy 17. So, Dr. Robertson's view is that policy servicing is limited if the words contribute to restoration, as it only seeks to contribute to the restoration and protection. It does not seek to restore and protect. It considers, considers that this wording is technically unspecific, given the clear direction of the Te Whanganui and the policy direction of the UGCSN. Dr. Robertson recommends more direct language is used in policy 17. He also considers that policy is further limited by the absence of numeric and narrative target attribute states for wetlands. And looking at question 11 in the wetlands witness statement, essentially asked whether Dr. Robertson's proposed narrative targets and target attribute states in his appendix 2 is evidence of measurable characteristics. Dr. Robertson's proposed that for total phosphorus and total nitrogen, narrative targets should be nutrient status, wetland soil and surface water is maintained within the healthy range for specific wetland type, or where degraded is improving. The experts at the conferencing agreed there are potential methods to maintain ecological integrity of freshwater wetlands where certain attributes could be determined within certain ranges. The experts also agree that there is guidance available to enable an assessment of the condition of wetlands in regard to the water quality contaminants. And so just moving then to policy 16 in relation to the Whangamaringa wetland. The Director General does not have an appeal point on this policy. The reason being is that the other parts of the plan, in Dr. Robertson's view, address our concerns and adequately provided for the restoration and protection of the wetland. And at that time, in the notice of the Director General's lodge, we did not see that seeking anything further would add to that. We thought what was in there was adequate. However, Dr. Robertson, and he can again speak to this, has had a change of view, particularly since the Blackwater event earlier this year, and as a result of the further degradation in this water body, his view is now that an FMU for the wetland has become more apparent. And so based on the Ministry for the Environment guidance, Dr. Robertson considers it is reasonable and necessary to establish an FMU for Whangamaringa wetland for several reasons. The proposed FMU is functionally appropriate from a hydrological and water quality management perspective, and special objectives, policies and associated numeric attribute states have already been identified in PCO for Whangamaringa wetland. And in the JWS wetlands, the experts agree that from a purely technical perspective, Whangamaringa wetland having its own FMU would be appropriate for freshwater management and accounting purposes. The proposed FMU would encompass all subcatchment upstream of Whangamaringa River confluence with the Waikato River, and that there is sufficient technical information to define the attributes and targets, as these are already set out in Table 3.11.3. As I note, this was not an appeal point for the Director General, but as a result of the recent events, and given that it comprises land managed by the Department, we are supporting Fish and Game's report on that. And just finally, turning to the implementation methods. So the context there serves that the Director General was seeking a whole lot more attribute target states to be included in PC1. Through mediation and offline discussions, it became very clear to us that the information necessary to do that isn't available. More monitoring is required. We understand that also this will be picked up again in a freshwater plan review. So with that in mind, the Director General pulled back on those attribute states and focused attention and energy on the implementation methods. Except for the dissolved oxygen issue, which seems to be, and I'll let Mr. McArthur speak to that, the extent of degradation since the plan was first notified is concerning to her from a scientific perspective, and so we are still seeking a dissolved oxygen in terms of climate change zone. And so the implementation 11.3.1, the Director General seeks a reference to the Whangamaringa wetland. Also imperative that the action plan continue in the Lake Waikare and Whangamaringa wetland catchment management plan. So you know, we're hearing that this isn't a binding catchment plan, it's not enforceable, but the priorities identified through that plan when it was developed is hugely relevant to measures to help restore and protect the wetland. And so we're advocating for those measures to be recognised to the extent possible within the scope of this plan. And that is around the lower Waikato flood scheme, which is outside of this process and is something that Barry the General is working with the Regional Council on. So we're not just putting all our eggs in the PC1 basket, we are seeking other measures outside of this process and within our statutory functions to help address the issues at the region and the other water bodies. The Director General considers amendments that are needed to provide clarity in terms of 311.3.2 implementation methods, to provide clarity around when a sub-catchment plan is required, and to ensure lakes and wetlands within sub-catchment are specifically included in sub-catchment scale planning. In the planning JWS, the experts mostly agreed with the wording proposed, and Mr. Mitrobalco's rebuttal evidence. Hissett continues to have concerns around consistency of sub-catchment timing and table 311.3 in terms of when a sub-catchment plan will be prepared. So it's just around some clarity into removing the uncertainty as to when those plans are required. The Director General seeks amendments to coordinate monitoring of wetlands, estuarine and coastal environments to ensure period phytum growth, dissolved oxygen and microphyte are monitored and to include nutrients at the sub-catchment scale. Again, experts in the planning at JWS agreed to the wording proposed by Mr. Trebilco. And in terms of 311.3.4, the Director General considers amendments to require 3-year review and monitoring towards progressing of criteria finding and to include methods for monitoring or further development of attributes. Experts have agreed in the JWS planning to the wording again proposed by Mr. Trebilco. And so I submit that without adequate implementation methods for PC1, we've largely set a framework where implementation is left to future processes, such as the freshwater review and farm plans. The implementation methods largely agreed by the planning experts would play a significant role in ensuring there's actual progress on the implementation of PC1. And that concludes my little submission.
You've heard the court's questioning in relation to section 293, and our concerns there arise primarily from making sure that the plan change becomes operative as soon as possible. Do you have any views you'd like to express to the court on use of 293 in the three circumstances we're talking about?
In terms of the risk index, the gateway tool, you mean?
Yes, in terms of the gateway tool.
Yeah, I guess the answer is no, in short, simply because the issue is an issue that is being driven by another agency, which we call the environment. And so in terms of recognising any concerns from the Director General in that space, we liaise directly with the Ministry for the Environment. So it's a whole of government approach there. I'm not sure if I'm making sense here. I guess we haven't engaged or put any appeal points in around the tool, other than making sure there's a placeholder for an alternative tool, given that oversea is not appropriate in all aspects of this plan. So in terms of the relief that the Director General is seeking in the appeal points, we've sought those within the scope of the appeals, so we don't see any need for a 293 in terms of any appeals that the Director General is seeking. Not sure if that's, but we were leaving the other issues to those parties that are most relevant to them.
Thank you, that's helpful. Thank you very much. Thank you for picking up on the issue of the economic evaluation. It's something that I know is of concern to you, and the fact that you're addressing it. Can you just explain how you see that working in relation to the work that the council is doing, possibly with input from federated farms and things like that? Do you see them being done together, or are you seeing yours as a completely separate exercise to what the council would do?
Yeah, I would like to see it be done together, sir. So do you mean in terms of the questions put together?
My very rough list of questions. And if we could have a single response from all parties, that would be the most useful for the court. Is that what people are working towards?
Yes, sir. And so on that note, we have forwarded to the parties the comments from the Director General's experts on the list prepared by the court.
Yes.
So that's with the parties for consideration. And as I understand it, one log of comments will come to the court.
Thank you. That's very helpful. That's what I was hoping.
Yes.
Just on that, there is an issue of air expertise that needs to be incorporated, and that's the expertise of farmers in terms of how fencing will actually be done.
Yes.
And it's very clear that fences are not built in circles.
Yes.
There are a few challenges with that. And when I looked at Mr. Cameron's evidence, he actually put in some relatively recent quotes for fencing. And a single gate costs $880 plus GST. Similarly, there's corner posts and things like that. So I'm keen to ensure that when we get information back, it reflects the reality of how it will be done on site. Is that what you're expecting to happen?
Yes, sir. And I can only re-emphasise that coming to this process and seeking the measures that we're seeking, particularly around stock exclusions, we have not closed our minds to the cost. We understand the cost and like the extent of those costs, but equally there are huge benefits to also be understood there.
We understand that, and certainly the issues you raised about the 5 metres and the 10 metres, that we understand those very clearly.
Sure.
So that's helpful, thank you.
And just to reiterate, we're more than happy to work with all the parties in putting something together for the court.
Thank you. And you raised the issue of when targets are reached, and I think that's a very, very important issue. And it is something that I will be asking Ms. MacArthur about, and so I've given her a little bit of prior warning on that. And it's again reality, and I keep coming back to this, but it's no good us all moving forward assuming something's going to be happening in 2 years and it's going to take 10.
Yes.
And so I want to explore some of those ideas.
Yes.
And the reason for saying this is that the FEPs will not be in immediately. It's going to be a number of years before the FEPs are all certified. Then there's a period to get the actual actions required done. So we're probably looking at 5 years out before we get to a point where people are all working towards achieving the outcomes. Then there's the period of the taking effect of those actions and being able to measure them in the environment. So I think it's really important that everyone has an honest assessment of how realistic is the 10-year target. My personal view is that it's very, very optimistic indeed in terms of the reality of how it may happen. So I always wear my heart on my sleeve in terms of the issues that are concerning me. The reason I do that is that people can then say, sorry, you're wrong. And I'm happy with that if that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need to have this degree of realism.
Yes, sir.
I'm really pleased. I think you do understand where my concerns are coming from. And they're all directed to trying to get the best outcome for the river system. So,
yes.
So I think I've made my point there, and given Ms. MacArthur enough warning of where you have a few questions. But the other issue is, what is your view on the court saying that certain things have to happen first? Because there are so many things that need to be done. And if we just say, do this, do this, do this, it's never going to happen because there's going to be too much.
Mm.
If the court was to say, we want some focus on this to start off with, not exclusively, you may need to focus in different areas. But do you have a view on that?
We turned our mind to, in addition to the 10-metre setbacks that is quite set for the Director General in terms of relief, we're open to the timing of that. So, and we would be guided by those parties who understand the timing in terms of implementing these measures. And so, if that, I guess what we're wanting to see in that time is some actual direction toward what's to be achieved in that, whatever that time frame is. So we're not as fixed in the time frame as such, it's more those measures in terms of this is the setback. So how that is put in place, when that is put in place, we're by and large guided by the parties who will be most impacted by it.
Thank you very much, that's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll move to your
thank you, sir.
Volume 320.
So the Director General calls Ms. MacArthur.
Do you solemnly confirm and truly declare and affirm that the evidence you are about to give this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. MacArthur.
Good morning.
Your full name is Catherine Jane MacArthur?
Yes, sir.
And you hold the qualifications set out in your evidence?
I do.
And you prepared evidence dated the 28th of July?
Yes.
And you prepared a rebuttal dated the 11th of August?
Yes.
And you also participated in expert conferencing for water quality on the 4th and 5th of September?
I did.
Do you have any corrections to your evidence?
I do have one to my evidence in chief, and that is at paragraph 46 on page 16. I think the bundle page number is 320.0275. In this paragraph is one sentence, third line down. Sorry, I need my glasses on. Can't read my own writing. Acknowledging that further attributes consistent with the broader range of components necessary for ecosystem health to be supported may be introduced, and it says there, into PC1 via the proposed freshwater policy review. I'd just like to delete the words into PC1 and refer there to the Waikato and Waipark catchments. I don't think it's correct to say that they may be introduced into PC1 via the freshwater plan review.
So we can just delete into PC1, or do you feel we should insert there for the Waipa and Waikato catchment?
Oh, I think probably just deleting the words.
Deleting those words.
So
I think that's clear. Thank you.
Do you have any other corrections?
No.
Do you confirm your evidence to be true and correct to the best of your belief and knowledge?
I do.
I have a few questions, sir.
Absolutely.
So you have been listening in on the hearing last week?
Yes, sir.
So you would have heard around, you would have heard discussions about where the proposed 10-year setback should start for permanent river?
Yes.
And so how would you measure, where would you start a 10-metre setback in terms of permanent rivers?
When I looked at the definition that's in the existing regional plan, which does define the bed and the banks of a river, there's a very helpful diagram in there, and I largely agree with that definition that it is the edge of the bank at which a bank will flow or measure. So I can't remember the exact words off the top of my head. But I did find that definition very helpful, particularly with the diagram that was provided as guidance. So from the edge of the bank that the bank full flow will reach before it reaches the bank and floods. This is to me the edge, and then there would be a 10 metres landward from that edge.
Thank you, Mr. Harper. And so there has been a lot of discussion in the hearings so far about the most appropriate widths for setbacks from water bodies. And so given your experience in other regional planning processes, are you aware of any other regions where setbacks are greater than those proposed in PC1 on the national spot regulations?
I think at either end of the country, both the Southland Water and Land Plan appeals in the interim decision of Judge Borthwick, and also in Northland in the court decision from Judge Smith. There are some differences in the approaches taken in those plans, and they're quite activity specific. So in the Southland case, it's referring specifically to setback distances in relation to intensive winter grazing, but also pasture-based wintering of cattle and cultivation. The setbacks for those activities were 10 metres at a slope less than 10 degrees and 20 metres at a slope 10 degrees or greater, the reasoning being that as slope increases, a larger buffer is needed in order to effectively remove contaminants. For Northland, I believe the slope was set at 10 metres for cultivation, so that covered cultivation practices quite widely. And it was up 10 metres unless the NES fresh water setbacks prevailed under some of the standards. So 10 metre and larger setbacks are not unheard of in other plans that I've been involved in.
Thank you, Ms. McArthur. And so is it your evidence that to be effective, all setbacks require planted riparian vegetation?
No, not necessarily. Some of the studies that I've referenced in my literature review that I included in my evidence in chief looked at a variety of vegetation types. Some of them were meta-analysis, which means they analysed a large number of other pieces of research, and they looked at grass swards as being quite effective sediment and contaminant trappers, or trees on their own with respect to reductions in nitrate and phosphate, in addition to some reductions in sediment as well. So in my view, if your contaminant of most interest is sediment, then a grass sward is adequate within that buffer zone. It doesn't necessarily require the planting of woody riparian vegetation.
Thank you. And so there's also been a lot of discussion around the ephemeral streams versus internal streams and critical source areas. In your opinion, can these be prioritised in any way in terms of which ones should be managed?
I don't know about prioritised, but what we do know from the research is that a large proportion of the contaminant load comes through the headwater network of streams, and that headwaters is a little bit of a different definition to breaking things down into ephemeral and intermittent stream types. So headwaters would include probably some of both of those words. I say words because it's quite difficult from a technical perspective to be able to determine where an ephemeral stream ends and an intermittent stream begins. It's really a planning definition that's in the plan currently. And I think with respect to prioritising, ephemeral streams are generally critical source areas, and therefore it's kind of in the name of them that they are critical in terms of prioritising catchment transport into the wider stream network.
And so could these be identified through a farm environment plan process?
Yes, they can be identified on the ground. Generally, because of their ephemeral nature, you would want to go out after heavy rainfall and and you have the ability to look at where those wetland flow paths and deposition of watery areas and seeing where they connect to the drainage network more easily than you would under dry conditions.
And just finally, you've expressed concerns with there not being a dissolved oxygen target in the plan.
Yes.
Can you just explain your concern around that?
I listened to Dr. Sarsbrook's evidence and I found that quite helpful in terms of him identifying the areas he considers of most risk, being the Lower Waikato Basin and the lakes associated with that basin, as well as the lowland soft bottom streams. Where I disagree with Dr. Sarsbrook is in he spoke of there potentially being natural low DO streams, which make it difficult to understand what the natural DO state might be and therefore to set a reasonable target. I differ in my opinion on that because natural streams, the diurnal variation, so the variation in dissolved oxygen between night and day, is much lower than in a stream that's quite heavily impacted, particularly by nutrients. Nutrients in the stream drive the productivity, therefore the movement of dissolved oxygen between the minimum at night and the maximum during the day, the amplitude of that change is quite a lot larger than in a natural stream. So understanding what the dissolved oxygen minimum will be in relation to a target requires an understanding of that diurnal fluctuation. I'd also add that in the areas identified by Dr. Sarsbrook, finding a lowland stream in natural condition might be quite difficult, given the degree of modification to the stream network in Lower Waikato.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Please remain and answer any questions.
Thank you. How I should have thought of this earlier, an issue that may now arise is whether or not the order of questions needs to be revised, and in particular where the Regional Council's counsel should come in order. Simply to make things a little bit easier, I'd be inclined to stick with the general order that we've had previously. People's views and positions in relation to plan change matters. I don't think that this is one of those cases where it's necessarily a sharp division between those who support the council and those who oppose the council, which would often be the basis for the order. So just before I come to where the regional council fits into the list, is there anyone who disagrees with me continuing using the order that we've used up until now? Ms. Horan.
Sir, I think I should go first, given that I am very aligned with the drop case.
Oh.
And just to let you know, I have no questions from Mr. Calafate.
And that saves the problem. Thank you for volunteering that, Ms. Ongley. That would have been one of the obvious connections there. So, anyone else have anything to say about order? Conway, we think you should
sit in. So I'm quite relaxed about that. I'm happy to kick off if that's useful. But I'm really reading your hands as to what you think would be most helpful.
Well, it may well be quite useful for you to go first. So if there is anything that you can put forward on behalf of the Regional Council as a proponent of the plan change, then others will hear that and they can follow on with that. Whereas if you were to address certain things at the tail end, I imagine I might find your colleagues wanting to leap to their feet and say, well, hang on, I didn't know he was going to say that. All right, well, we can do it that way then. Any issue with that, anyone? On that basis, Mr. Conway, any questions for the witness?
Yes, thank you. Now I want to start by talking about and you might be able to help me with a clarification just to make sure I've got an understanding of the Director General's case in terms of the question about the interim or the target attribute states that the Director General is seeking. I had understood, certainly prior to your council opening, that there was a request, and certainly in line with your Appendix 4, for a review of target attribute states for nitrate and ammonia and toxicity. And through comments just made in an opening this morning, I understand now the request is only for dissolved oxygen, and it might be them as to my can confirm or otherwise, but if my understanding based on those comments is that the Appendix 4 review of targets and nitrate and ammonia toxicity are no longer scored. Am I, if I'm correct about that, then I don't need to ask questions about that.
My understanding is
Yes.
The recommendation from Ms. MacArthur is that the nitrates relate to dissolved oxygen, so they are, I should have, that's right, Ms. MacArthur?
I don't withdraw any of the evidence that I've presented on nitrate and ammonia toxicity. I'll let you speak to the DGS.
Yes, and that relates to dissolved oxygen?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Mr. Conway is just asking Sue, sorry, that I had confirmed earlier in my submission that it was dissolved oxygen that was the main concern in terms of the attributes. We continue to seek that, and that's as far as we're going.
So dissolved oxygen is my main concern with adding additional attributes to Table 3.11.1. My concerns around nitrate and ammonia toxicity are around changes to the existing attribute states that are in that table.
Okay, thank you, that is helpful. Now, in terms of, I will just touch briefly on those nitrate and ammonia toxicity targets then, because these are dealt with in your Appendix 4, where you recommended some amendments.
Yes.
And this is available for the court 320.1521. And Ms. MacArthur, in terms of those, Dr. Scarsbrook has said in his evidence in rebuttal of paragraph 15, and he reiterated at the hearing last week, that the freshwater policy review will include development of targets for nitrogen and phosphorus for ecosystem health, which will likely be more stringent than those based on toxicity. Do you recall that evidence he's given?
I do, and we have had some discussions on that. My concern is, one, that toxicity needs to be addressed quite soon in order to reduce that directly toxic effect on aquatic life. And the second of my concerns relates to, I have not seen the technical basis on which those dissolved nitrogen and phosphorus targets will be set, so I don't have a good technical understanding of what they will look like on a subcatchment basis and what they will be based on, so essentially where those targets might be set and whether those will be adequately protective and more stringent than the toxicity targets.
Right, so that's it's a matter that needs to be worked out through that freshwater policy review in order to clarify that for you.
In terms of ecosystem health, yes, I've limited my evidence here to the all contaminants of concern, with the exception of dissolved oxygen.
Yes. And as a general proposition then, without obviously knowing the detail of what might be proposed through the freshwater policy review, would you agree with Dr. Scarsbrook that targets for nitrogen and phosphorus for ecosystem health would likely be more stringent than those based on toxicity, or is it not something you can comment on?
So they'll likely be more stringent than the nitrate toxicity attribute states that are applied in PC1, but not necessarily more stringent than the ammonia states, because the national bottom lines for ammonia, and I can't recall them completely off the top of my head, but stringent as the requirements for dissolved nitrogen and phosphorus. So where a river is more heavily affected by the ammoniacal forms of nitrate, the ammonia toxicity, national bottom line, or targets that are set in PC1 may not, they may be more stringent than the dissolved nitrogen and phosphorus targets. So yes for nitrogen, no for ammonia.
Thank you, that's very clear. And in terms of where that leaves us with toxicity in the meantime, in the water quality joint witness statement, there were some comments made in Page 9.
Page number 9.
Yes, in the document, in fact, the version I've got is not educational, which is so unhelpful, sorry, but. You've got the joint witness statement there.
I do. I believe the bundle reference might be 401.0008.
Thank you very much. Question 9. Mr. White entitled, is there any evidence that the current states of nitrate and ammonia constrain biological communities in the sediment subcations of concern to you?
Yes.
That's right. And I just want to briefly check a couple of points there. At points 3 and points 5, there are comments there made in relation to ammonia and nitrate respectively. At point 3, in terms of ammonia, the experts confirmed there are 3 subcatchments in which the baseline state is worse than the national bottom line. And while this corresponds to an increased risk of chronic, i.e., sublethal effect on most sensitive species, these concentrations are not at levels that would be expected to constrain biological communities in these subcatchments. However, ammonia concentration should be managed as a priority in these catchments. Now, from that point there, in terms of matters of disagreement, I take it you disagree with that statement, but it's a statement that other experts confirm that they agree with.
I disagree with part of that statement, and the part that I disagree with, and I apologise if it wasn't clear from the disagreement statement, is these concentrations are not at levels that would be expected to constrain biological communities. And the reason I disagree with that part of the statement is that sublethal effects can have effects on the growth of sensitive organisms and fish in particular, and if fish don't grow as large, to be frank, they don't fit as many eggs in them, and the eggs that do fit in them are smaller, and thus the actual reproductive success is known to be lower where growth rates are constrained.
Thank you. And then at point 4, there's a similar statement made in relation to nitrate, and I understood, similar to the confirmation you've just given the court, that you've got a similar level of disagreement in relation to the way that refers to constraining biological communities. Is that what I understood that correctly?
Yes, I would disagree with that part of the statement that says constrain biological communities.
Thank you. Turning now to the interim target attribute states for dissolved oxygen. In your evidence, you have proposed paragraph 119, which is on page 320, bound reference 320.0297. You confirm there that you have recommended some interim target attribute states for dissolved oxygen in all subcatchments. And you're familiar with Dr. Scarsbrook, his evidence at paragraph 21 of his rebuttal that he does not support adding those interim target attribute states on the basis that this has been looked at for the freshwater policy review and will be premature at this stage. You're familiar with that evidence?
I understand that to be his view.
Would you accept that it's important to understand the baseline state when setting targets?
Not necessarily. reason I hold that view is due to the nature of the national bottom line. And I believe it is in Table 7 of the NPSFM that it describes the meaning of the national bottom line in terms of effect. To remind myself of that. And the national bottom line attribute band description is moderate stress on a number of aquatic organisms caused by dissolved oxygen levels exceeding preference levels for periods of several hours each day, risk of sensitive fish and macroinvertebrate species being lost. So I think, regardless of what your current baseline status is, that in terms of looking after aquatic life, that you could set that bottom line with confidence that that would at least be a good starting point to set a target attribute state.
Thank you. If you didn't have the understanding of the current state, then at that point you'd accept, though, that it's difficult to know exactly how much is needed to get from where we are currently to where that target was and the level of imposition that might involve in terms of wider matters such as level of change needed to land use and land management when we're informing a Section 32 analysis.
That's kind of two questions. Can you remind me of the first one?
In essence, in order to know how much improvement's needed, it's important to understand the gap between current state and your target state, essentially.
Yes, I think that would be the case in some parts of the catchment. My evidence is really in relation to those parts of the catchment where we are very likely to know that at some stages the dissolved oxygen is significantly low enough to cause catastrophic events such as those that Dr. Robertson and Mr. Clee describe in their evidence. It's a very high probability that those sites are below the national bottom lines. I think that results in a change to my Appendix 4, and I was really waiting for Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence that he gave on where those problems occur within the catchments, and the list that he gave of where the problems are at highest potential to cause those events, in which case, rather than providing a national bottom line in Table 3 or Level 1 for all sub-catchments, I think it would be useful to target where that national bottom line was applied in relation to the catchments that Dr. Scarsbrook identified as at greatest risk. And I think that's a change to my evidence that is consistent with the list that he's given.
Well, just in terms of the court's record, are there particular changes that you'd like to direct the court to now to your Appendix 4? If that can't be done efficiently now, but it's something you want to provide later.
I was really hoping that the Council might provide on a sub-catchment basis which sub-catchments were captured by the broader list of places that Dr. Scarsbrook talked of, and if that could be provided, then I would happily amend to my Appendix 4 to be relevant to that.
So that relies on further work that's being done rather than being something that's necessary.
No, I think it just it relies on spatially identifying Dr. Scarsbrook's statements by sub-catchment, so I can be sure that I have all of the relevant sub-catchments in the box, as it were.
Okay. Now, turning to attribute states more generally, I think it's probably a fair summary that in general terms you would like to see more and stricter target attribute states or interim ones in Plan Change 1. Is that a fair general statement?
I don't think it's a general statement. I think it really applies to those identified toxicity attributes, excuse me, rather than generally across the board. It really requires the addition of other attributes to come into that table to apply that kind of stringency separate to toxicity.
And then in terms of the elements that we've already traversed today, obviously Dr. Scarsbrook's there, his view of why some of those ones that you've identified are not being made stricter at this point. Despite that point of disagreement, would you agree that implementing PC1 in the form sought by the council, including the stock exclusion requirements that are in there at present, accepting that you have some different views about those, which we'll come to. In its current form, implementing PC1 as per the post-conferencing version would contribute to contaminant reductions in waterways. Is that a fair statement?
It would contribute to the degree to which that we could say we were getting closer to the targets or meeting the targets, I think remains unclear.
Yes, I understand that's essentially the point of difference. So it's not about whether these measures will have benefits, it's about how much benefit and how close they'll get to the target.
Yes, I think.
And in terms of an on-farm perspective, putting yourself in the shoes of a farmer, would you agree that having clear stock exclusion requirements that apply to them is likely to have more clear meaning on a day-to-day basis to an individual landowner than what a sub-catchment interim target says?
Well, I think those are two separate things. So we've agreed in the joint witness statement that the degree of change relative to the targets is important catchment contextual information. On the ground, and I can't give you a farm system's response to this, so it would simply be anecdotal as to what I've observed. On the ground, I think you have to understand the context, but you also require clarity around what needs to be done. I agree that clarity on the ground is useful and important.
Yes, and for an individual farmer, understanding that they need to exclude stock from particular types of waterways is a practical matter that they can understand on the ground, which may have more relevance to day-to-day farming activities than a particular sub-catchment target that understood is important, but is not quite as easy to reconcile with day-to-day management of your farm.
Sorry, can you repeat that question? That was quite a long tail on the end of it.
Having a clear requirement to exclude stock from particular water bodies,
yes,
is likely to have a more direct applicational meaning to a farmer on their farm than a sub-catchment target.
Okay, I'm with you, sorry. Yes, I agree. Noting that the context of the reduction required, either within your sub-catchment or more generally over the whole catchment, and probably both of those things, is something that needs to be more clearly communicated. Because there's the linkage between the on-farm practices on the ground and the sub-catchments is not necessarily apparent through the plan provision.
And having on-farm measures like stock exclusion and operative provisions will lead to benefits to water quality, whether or not there is agreement on what particular sub-catchment interim target is set. Do you agree with that?
Yes, as long as the stock exclusion is done in an effective manner.
So turning to setbacks now, you've recommended in your evidence, I think it's essentially a blanket 10 minutes effect from all lakes, permanent rivers, and ephemeral headwaters. Is that
a no, that's
no?
Correct.
Okay.
So it's a 10 metre setback from permanent rivers, actually lakes and wetlands to the department's other experts.
Ah, sorry.
10 metre setback from permanent rivers and 3 metres from intermittent and ephemeral streams.
Right, thank you. That's helpful. In terms of width, from a water quality perspective, albeit that there may be diminishing returns as one gets wider, generally the position is that the wider the better. Is that fair?
Yes, the wider the better, and the greater the slope, the wider requirement to be effective.
Yes. Do you agree with Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence with references to paragraph 70 that the identification of appropriate setbacks, not black and white, and that there will be stream sections where narrow setbacks provide adequate protection and others where wider setbacks will be more beneficial?
In theory, that's a very requires quite specific ground truth to be able to definitively say whether that statement is correct or not in a particular circumstance.
Yes, and so a process that enables that ground truth to happen will be important rather than having necessarily one wide setback that may not be applicable in all situations.
Well, I think a minimum is a useful start to being clear about what is required.
Thank you. And in terms of ephemeral streams, Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence is that his view it would be impractical to exclude stock from all ephemeral streams, and in some cases it would require a complete redesign of paddock layout and grazing management. Do you accept that that's a difference of view that you and he have, or do you accept some of what he said in that study?
No, I can't speak to paddock management and layout because that's outside my area of expertise. What I can speak to is the treatment of ephemeral streams as critical source areas, and that probably being the best approach. The number of levers to control the flow of contaminants into critical source areas does include setbacks and fencing, is my understanding from some of the guidelines that I have seen.
Yes, and I understand it was confirmed this morning by your council that in the joint witness statement for water quality, we moved on to question 42, and most ephemeral waterways would be captured by the definition of critical source or the areas. That's, I think that's essentially capturing what you've just said, or at least part of what you've said.
So not all critical source areas will be ephemeral waterways, but almost all ephemeral waterways will be critical source areas, whether in farming or cropping.
Yes, and that's perhaps evident even to my lay perspective from looking at the critical source area definition in the provisions.
Yes.
And have you got the provisions there with you, the post-conferencing version?
I'll have to grab those out of the bundles because direct me.
Thank you. So I think you've got a black and white version which should be sufficient for our purposes now. So this is the version that Mr. Dravilko has produced post-conferencing.
Yes.
And if you can turn through to Schedule D1, in particular page 44, hopefully there's page 44 on the bottom right hand side of the page.
Sorry, I don't have any page numbers,
Alright, in that case, let's get through to Schedule D1. Let me know when the Refugee D1 sets out the requirements for farm environment plans for farming that does not require a resource consent. And it's divided into a few different parts, but essentially this is what we've been calling it a standards-based farm environment plan needs to capture. Over a couple of pages in Part D standards, there was a numerical list of standards in the fourth of land and soil. Have you got that, Fabian?
Yes, I have.
The first of those land and soil standards says actions to minimise sediment loss from critical source areas are undertaken as soon as possible in accordance with a plan which prioritises those which are in Schedule C Clause 5 water bodies. Would you accept those actions, subject to obviously the question of what they might be in practice, are likely to have benefits for ephemeral streams, given that most ephemeral streams will be critical source areas?
Sorry, I'm not following what paragraph you're on. Oh, land and soil.
Yes.
Okay, I'm with you now.
So you've got that clause in there.
Yes, and that is subject to the matter that you raised in terms of knowing what those management actions that you would put in your plan are to a degree, and having some guidance as a minimum or specificity potentially within the plan as to what that might encompass.
And so in terms of the way that the farm environment advisor would need to approach this, they would need to identify their actions, and they would need to be satisfied that those measures would minimise sediment loss from critical source areas. So that's a specific direction to them, isn't it, that would have benefit for ephemeral streams?
Yes, but I'm not sure that sediment is the only contaminant of concern with respect to managing critical source areas. So microbial pathogens in particular are relevant here, and to some degree nutrients.
All right. Turning over a few pages, we've got the Schedule D2 requirements for farm environment plans. Resource requires a resource consent. So these are more principles and goals based. They likewise have a Part D of these named Goal 4 on page 49 of my version, maybe on yours. You'll see there that in relation to farming that requires a resource consent, Goal 4 is to minimise losses of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens to waterways. And the principles there which would need to be implemented into a farm environment plan that requires resource consent is to identify the risk of overland flow of the full contaminants on the property and implement measures to minimise transport flows. So that covers all four, and it requires identification of risk and implementation of measures, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And in particular, the next principle, 11, talks about locating and or managing a range of areas, including critical source areas, to minimise risks to water quality.
Yes, so I think that could be excuse me, clearer to identify ephemeral streams or ephemeral flow paths. Because there are two types of critical source areas, the first being things like farm tracks, gateways, water troughs, where there is stock traffic, and then the second being the actual drainage network itself. And I think if that was identified in here, that would be clearer that those are the things you're looking to achieve this goal.
Given that the definition itself is clear, the definition of critical source area deals with
Yes, I think the bit that's missing in terms of clarity there is the part I talked about that are critical source areas that are not necessarily associated with the drainage network. I think it's reasonably clear in terms of identifying the drainage network, but I think that I've heard some confusion over critical source areas and are not necessarily understanding that there are two components to those, and I'm not sure that that's clear from this definition, but I do understand it to be consistent with the regulations.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour. Thank you, Mr. Conway. We'll take morning adjournment now. In terms of what we've discussed, the River Authority would come next. I'm not going to go through the whole list of time with those questions. We'll return at 22. Thanks very much.
Yeah,
you're that morning tea, you just can't talk to anyone. What's your problem?